What's chomping away on your garden produce? What's riding the wind to join your garden party to feast on what should be your vegetable delectables? Diane Alston, USU Extension entomologist, will be in studio to take your gardening questions. In our Petals and Prose segment, Helen Cannon will remind us of what was known as the carpet flower-o-rama. It's flowers in a can. Mike Coons reminds us in Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That, why aspen is not such a great tree to plant. Then we'll talk with David Wallace from Cache Hikers about a rare treat taking place along the Jardine Juniper hike up Logan Canyon. The elkweed is in blossom. That's all today on The Zesty Garden, but first, the news. This is The Zesty Garden, and it's our Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That segment. Mike Coons, Extension Forestry Specialist at Utah State University, is here to talk about why you should not plant an aspen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you have a globe Navajo willow, I've already lost all credibility with you, but we'll talk about aspens. And aspens are actually in the same plant family as willows. It's the Salicaceae, so it's the willow and cottonwood and poplar and aspen family. And aspens are a little different than those others. They don't quite need as much water as a willow, a typical willow. Well, really, any willow needs a lot of water. And most cottonwoods and poplars need a lot of water. Aspen doesn't need quite as much water, but it's got plenty of problems. And an aspen is a beautiful tree in the mountains, and I think that's where it belongs. But people aren't planting those. They're forests that are regenerating themselves. If your neighbors have aspens, you also have aspens. And I cut one down, had it cut down for me about 15 years ago. And for years afterwards, 2 or 3 years, I would have sprouts come up in my lawn, more than did even before I cut it down. You know, you get them all the time.
And they get those little knobs wherever you cut those down.
And yeah, and so I religiously sprayed any that would come up with this kind of super Roundup type stuff. Plus, then, I would go to my neighbors' yards and ask them if it was okay. If I saw an aspen sprout coming up above the fence, I'd go and cut it down and treat the stump. And I thought I had them all gone. And then a neighbor was doing some tree removal, and I went over and realized it was one of my aspens that had gotten up to, boy, it was maybe 8 or 10 inches in diameter, and I had missed it. And so now he's actually going to make his final cut on the stump in the next few days, and I'm going to loan him the bottle of stump. It's not stump killer, but it's a herbicide that you put on a stump that translocates down in and gets most of the roots.
So you just put it on a fresh stump. That's how it works.
Yeah.
Now, you don't have to drill a hole and fill the holes up or anything?
No. And the chemical in it, when you see the really fine print on pesticide labels, look for triclopyr, T-R-I-C-L-O-P-Y-R. That's the main problem with aspens, is they just go where you don't want them to. And they, like others in their family, they also are quite insect and disease prone. Not as bad as willows, but they are insect and disease prone.
So where would you have them? What's the minimum elevation that you would grow them? So here in the valley, even on the bench, it's too low.
Yeah. And what you're getting at is obviously the forests do fine. But what's wrong with them down here? Well, the sprouting in your lawn is something that isn't an elevation problem. It's what they do. It's how they mostly how they regenerate.
So they're all clones, usually,
right?
Big clumps of clones.
Yeah. It is the cool and moist conditions up in the mountains that make them more suitable up there and less insect and disease prone, especially insect prone.
Don't have the insects that bother them down here up there as much?
That's probably part of it, and then they may be able to thwart the insects a little better.
Not stressed as much?
Yeah, right. And so they have more energy, more food reserves that they can possibly put into chemicals that protect them. And I would say just think of where you start seeing aspen when you go up the canyon, maybe 7,500 feet or something. They start pretty low, and they go all the way to, Logan Canyon, certainly they're all the way up, probably to tree line in higher mm-hmm. mountains like the Uintas. And there is one way to grow aspens in a residential landscape that I would like to mention, and that's for people who want that effect, but a way to avoid having this pretty good-sized tree that's full of borer holes and it's breaking and all sorts of problems, is don't ever let one of them get very big. So you decide where in your yard you're going to have an aspen grove, and then you plant two or three or four. Wait for the sprouts to start coming up. Never let the sprouts go into the lawn. If they come up, you take care of them, just like you have to if you have a single tree.
But they'll be less likely to get into the lawn if they're small.
No,
not so much?
No, you're going to get them.
Okay.
And so you
still have to put up with that.
Yeah, this is if you're willing to put up with having to get rid of sprouts where you don't want them. But let some sprouts come up in that bed you've created, and then always thin the sprouts to where you don't have lots of them and to where you like the look of it, and then never let any one of them get bigger than the rule of thumb I use is what you could easily cut down in an hour at home, without special tools, which means you're really not going to let the thing get taller than 20 feet and maybe 4 or 5 inches in diameter.
At the most, I would imagine.
Yeah, and so you'd have two or three getting up towards that size, a few small ones, and then you'd remove many of them within that bed because you wouldn't want them every 6 inches apart,
So how much in diameter would you not let them get any bigger?
I'm thinking 4 or 5 inches.
If the tree starts to look yellow mm-hmm. or diseased in any way or dripping, I don't know if it has the flux driving down the side.
No, but
you
certainly
can see disease.
You get weeping out of the borer holes.
Cut it down because you can't fix it.
Right, and you'll always have new ones coming. It's a more naturalized look. It's not a lollipop tree in the middle of the lawn look. But I think a lot of people who like aspens like that kind of naturalized feel. So I went back on what we said, that this is a tree never to plant. In fact, it's a fine tree where it's native, as are willows. But also there is a way, I think, to have them as long as you're willing to, you still have to put up with some sprouts.
So for this week's segment of Wait, Don't Plant That, don't plant an aspen unless you're willing to put up with some of the many problems that it has.
Yes.
Or you live at 7,500 feet of elevation or higher.
Yeah, not too many of us do.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate
you
coming in.
Thank you.
Mike Coons is a professor at Utah State University, and he is a teacher extraordinaire, among other things, but he is with USU's Extension Forestry as a specialist and as a regular guest on the Zesty Garden. Coming up next is our Petals and Pro segment. Helen Cannon is a former teacher of English at Utah State University and is a lover of literature and gardening, and she resides in Logan.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Pros. I've been thinking lately about imaginary gardens and real gardens and real work. Imaginary gardens can be good or bad. We need to be able to visualize gardens, both imagined and real. We need to plan, and we need to remember gardens with our memories. But there's a kind of imaginary garden that uses fantasy and that is not realistic and that doesn't acknowledge real work. I'll give you an example of this kind of imaginary garden. One day, one of my former students came to visit my garden, and I took her around. My husband and I worked pretty hard on our garden, and I told her about the flowers and the habits of the flowers and the names of the flowers and gave her quite a tour. And as she was leaving, she said, "So, this all just grows, huh?" Well, if she'd been taking a test from me, I think she would have failed. I think this is the subtext of a little section that Catherine White writes about in her Onward and Upward in the Garden that appeared in the New Yorker magazine periodically for several years. Speaking of gardening with less labor, a device called Flowerama burst upon a wondering world a year ago come May. You probably saw the exclamatory full-page ad in the Times. A scientific breakthrough. Amazing. Just unroll the magic carpet. No topsoil needed, no weeding, no work at all. Hundreds of gorgeous flowers all summer long, or your money back. So ran the pretty story. The carpet, it seemed, was, quote, a self-contained medium, and there were, quote, 101 ways to use it. You could cut it with scissors, place it around trees in circles. You could make figure eights and grow flowers in the shape of your initials. Although an unbeliever, I unlimbered my scissors and sent off my order for one carpet and my check for $4.95 to Horticulture Incorporated, the firm behind the new wonder. In due course, the carpet arrived. It was 18 feet long, medium gray, and looked like the stuff you put under wall-to-wall carpeting. It also looked like the messy interior lining of soft book mailing envelopes, and it was bursting with seed. I cut it in half, thinking to plant half for a solid mass of bloom and to spell out something with the other half, probably the word welcome, though I considered the words keep off. The dry seed sprang out of the carpet so alarmingly at my first attempt to fashion a letter that I abandoned the idea and decided we would settle for only a 9-foot, quote, riot of color. On a damp, warm evening in June, attended by a cloud of mosquitoes, I unrolled the half length of the magic carpet and laid it down as tenderly as if it were a baby on good soil at the edge of the vegetable garden. Following directions carefully, I watered it. Then nature took over, and we had the wettest June in years, bringing with it a crop of weeds that, despite the advertisement's claims, did not appear to be in the least cowed by the mulch of Flowerama's carpet. Our first magic flower was a lone Escholtzia. It struggled up painfully through the gray fibers in July. By mid-August, there was a small patch of tiny purple and brown pea-like blossoms, which I did not recognize. The first week of in September gave a handsome stand of Shirley poppies about a foot long. A solitary annual chrysanthemum followed. Well, that was all. The carpet had a tendency to scuff up in spite of the continuous wetness, and from June until frost, the long blanket lay there, looking as if a couple of Boy Scouts had spent the night in our garden end to end. Eventually, our dachshund, who is always inflamed by a stray rag, discovered it and carried bits of the blanket about with him from place to place. Well, considering all, it probably wasn't a fair test, but there can be no doubt that our Flowerama was a flop. Perhaps I didn't really want this form of magic. I didn't approve of it, and I notice that plants I don't approve of seldom do well. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
Helen Cannon is a former teacher of English at Utah State University and a lover of literature and gardening, and she resides in Logan. Coming up next is David Wallace. He's a lecturer in the Department of Biology at USU. He's also with the CASH chapter of the Utah Native Plant Society and one of the leaders for CASH Hikers, and we're going to learn about elkweed. Welcome to Take a Hike. David Wallace is in studio with me today again, and we're going to be talking about at least a commonly known plant called elkweed, but not so commonly seen. And as I was reading the description about it, I didn't realize that this particular plant, it reminds me of kind of like a century plant that blooms once every 10 years. So why don't you talk about this?
Yeah, sure. The plant is elkweed. It's probably its most accepted common name, although you may know it, or many of us may know it, by other names like the giant gentian or the monument plant. There's a few other names there that it's known as. But the giant gentian is one of these plants. This elkweed is one of these plants that are known as monocarpic. That means it lives for a long time in the vegetative state, and then it blooms and dies, sort of like the century plant that you mentioned. You probably see these, or you will see these periodically here and there as you hike in the mountains, but they come out in blooms once in a while in huge quantities. The synchronized blooming, and that's what we have right now in one of our local mountains. I just saw it. It was really neat, and I'd like to share that information with others.
So is it all over, or is it just in particular canyons?
You tend to see it here and there. Let me put it that way. It's just a few flowers here and there, a few plants at any given year. But when one of these mass blooming events happens, and they'll be able to have hundreds of flowers in one local area. I can't say for sure on how widespread that is right now, but we certainly have it going on in at least one location in Logan Canyon.
So the three-letter word "why" comes to mind. I would imagine that a lot of seeds germinate together, and so the plants go through this eight-year cycle?
Well, this year's cycle might be between 20 and 80 years.
Oh, okay. So anywhere between that amount of time.
Now, I'm not the researcher on this, but I have read some of the information about it. And it's believed that the plant will just live in the vegetative state. It's maybe a foot or so tall, as strap-like leaves that one of his other names is deer's ear, because it looks like when it's not blooming. And it just lives and stores up energy, and something triggers it, some environmental event, and it might be a particularly wet summer. It's suggested that about 4 years before it blooms, a wet summer has triggered the changes that will lead to the blooming.
I mean, that kind of adaptation just kind of fascinates me, that far in advance, if that's what happens, and then several years later, it's like in a desert, I guess, when you have a lot of seeds lying dormant, and then you have a really wet spring, and voila, you have lots of color.
Yeah, these wild plants have to have lots of strategies for survival, and many plants will have different factors that are needed before everything has to come together right before the plant will germinate, for example. It's really interesting. I know enough to know I don't know a lot about it, but it's certainly an interesting situation and a survival factor for these plants.
So let's talk about where you saw these particular plants blooming, because it sounds like some place that we all would like to go and see. It's like you mentioned a couple of weeks ago, the blue camas. It's kind of unusual. So this is another unusual plant that's in flower.
We saw this plant just the other day. We went on a hike through Wood Camp Hollow up to the Jardine Juniper in Logan Canyon. It's a fairly popular area. You can get there by driving east from Logan and Logan Canyon. I believe it's about 12 miles. Pull off there at the Wood Camp campground site. But don't stop in the campground. Just cross the river and go another quarter mile to the parking area. You can start the hike there. After about a half a mile, you'll start seeing the plants, mostly on the uphill side, and they'll be there for the next three quarters of a mile or so in large quantities, large numbers.
So on drier slopes or the more shaded slopes?
It's the open, dry slopes. In this case, they're the east-facing slopes because of the way the terrain goes. It grows around with sagebrush and other similar plants. There's a number of other wildflowers in the same area right now growing with it. There's a few penstemons. There's some northern sweet vetch and a few others as well, actually many others as well.
So what's going to be the best time to go see these? How long are they going to be in blossom?
I don't know for sure how long they'll last. We saw them on Father's Day. I guess they'll bloom for another, clear to mid-July, I'd say. You're probably seeing them.
So they're out quite a while.
Yeah, they have the stalk is huge. They're about 6 feet tall. And the young flowers, the buds will be at the top, and then the more mature flowers will be farther down, and at the bottom will be the seeds being formed. The blooming, well, maturation will progress slowly up the stalk, and when it's all done, then I guess we can call it over.
So that's another interesting adaptation, because if something happens to the plant, at least a few seeds develop and be deposited, But if it's a really good summer, the whole spike, what would you call?
This would be a raceme.
Okay.
That's the type of inflorescence. It's a long, straight section with the flowers on stems.
Talk about what the flowers look like, because I was quite surprised when you sent me a picture. To me, they remind me of a certain type of amaryllis.
Okay, I don't know the amaryllis,
yeah.
But from a distance, you'll see a tall stem with that has the flowers on it, the raceme. And as you get close, you'll see the smaller flowers. Now, they might be insignificant from a distance, but up close, they're really attractive. They're about an inch and a half across. They have four petals in a cross shape with purple markings on them, and then and an X across the center of the flower will be four stamens, and then there's with the pistil in the center. It's quite nice.
And as far as the name of, you brought up something a little bit earlier, an interesting fact about this particular plant.
Well, sure. Its scientific name is Fraseris speciosa, which means the showy Fraser plant, which is not very, very useful. I mentioned elkweed. It's called monument plant because it's so striking. But of special interest is the miner's name for it. In the Salt Lake area around by Alta, the miners knew it as the iron blossom. That name still exists, in a skier's lodge, the Iron Blossom Lodge. And if you look at the logo for that lodge, the iron blossom, it's a depiction of the flower, of the green gentian.
And I love the spelling of blossom.
Miners were kind of phonetic in their usage.
Now, with this particular hike, if you keep going, you'll end up at the Dardine Juniper, and it's a, was it a 10-mile?
It's a 10-mile round trip if you go all the way to the Dardine Juniper and back. And there's many other flowers to look at along the way.
And how would you rate this particular hike as far as it being strenuous or not?
I would say it'd be moderately strenuous just because of the distance. It's 10 miles. We did it in 6 hours. It's about 2,500 feet elevation gain, I think. You can go just a mile up to see the flowers or go the whole way. If you're really, really ambitious, you can go all the way to, there's a branch that'll take you to Tony Grove and beyond.
And as far as what else you'll see along the hike, you mentioned a lot of wildflowers will be out. Will you be in both dry and shady areas?
This is a nice hike because it has a wide variety, a lot of different conditions, so you have a lot of different flowers. One of the first ones you'll see on the way up in a wet area will be the Jacob's Ladder, the white Polemonium, Scarlet Gilia along the dry slopes, the Pentstemons, as I already mentioned. There's a nice spring that you'll encounter where there's some yellow columbines, one of my favorites. When you get to the top, there's a loop. You don't have to go back in your exact steps when you go to the Jardine Juniper. And then on the shady side of that loop, we found a coral root orchid, for example. Hmm. Some nice plants.
Now, we have to mention the Dardine Juniper and what it is, because a lot of people don't know how important this tree is.
Well, it certainly is well-known up here in Logan, at least I believe it is. It's one of the oldest plants that we know. It's about a 1,500 years estimated life. It's a Rocky Mountain juniper, the one that has the finer leaves and then our more common lower elevation Utah juniper. It grows on a rocky outcrop, which probably is what saved its life. When you look around it, its roots are like 10 feet up in the air because the surrounding soil has washed away or eroded away, but the particular location for this juniper allowed it to be stable. It has a huge lower portion, large diameter, but it looks pretty much dead until you run your eyes up to the top and you see there's a nice little branch with green leaves still on it. Still, it's hanging in there.
You don't get many opportunities to see a 1,500-year-old tree. So might as well see some flowers and the tree along the way.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Now, the trail itself, is it pretty well developed? You said a lot of hikers use it. Are bikers on it as well?
Yeah, the trail is multiple use. You know, hikers, horsemen, and bicyclists can use it.
Non-motorized, though?
Non-motorized. Yeah. It's in excellent condition. There's a little bit of trail work going on. I saw some work on some water drainage structures, recent work, so the Forest Service has apparently been up there. But the tread is in great shape. We found one tree across the trail. That was the only problem we encountered the whole way.
And you said it took you 6.5 hours?
Yeah, about 6 hours for the whole trip.
And how much stopping did you do?
Well, there was some plant photography going on, which tended to slow the group down a little bit. But for most of the time, we went at a reasonable pace.
This could be a hike for the next couple of weeks, these flights. You said mid-July?
My guess is it'll be out until mid-July, and you may find it in other places and at other elevations as well.
Okay, and we'll have maps on our website. Go to upr.org and click on Programs, and then you'll see a drop-down menu. Just go to the Zesty Garden and find this particular topic, and you'll be able to get these. They're topographical maps, and I love that you put arrows on here that show kind of where to look for the Fusaria.
Frisera, okay. Or elkweed, or monument plant, whatever you want.
Monument plant sounds pretty good. All right, thank you very much for coming in again.
Thank you.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Cash Theater Company, presenting Anne of Green Gables, the musical. The story of Anne Shirley, performed for 50 years in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, comes to Utah, June 21st through 29th at the Logan High School Theater. Information at cashtheater.com.
Hello and welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. In studio with me right now is Diane Alston. She is Utah State University's extension entomologist, and we're going to be talking insects, and especially today talking about pollinators. And I had the unique opportunity the last couple of days. I was doing what they call a trek and pushing a hand cart the last several days up Blacksmith Fork Canyon toward the top of the canyon, and I got to see a lot of different insects. I wish I knew their names better than I did, but it was fun to see what they were pollinating, if they were pollinators, if they were horseflies, what they were attacking. So let's talk.
Not you.
Yeah. So they're not pollinating me, that's for sure. So why don't you give a little bit of an idea of what pollinators really are? 90% of them, as we talked before the program, or above, are usually bees, but there are all different types of pollinators.
Yeah, so bees make up the vast majority of insects or organisms that are primary pollinators for plants across the globe, across the world. And so when entomologists talk about pollinators, they're often, you know, focused on bees. But there's many different kinds of bees, and we can get back to that a little bit later. But it's not just honeybees or bumblebees that most people think about. There's a vast diversity of bees. Central and southern Utah and places like that are especially blessed with lots of diversity of bees. It's amazing. A lot of those desert plants, they have very specialist bees that pollinate them, and so they're generally fairly rare or unique and localized populations. But beyond bees, there are other insects that pollinate plants as well. So some of those that people tend to think about especially are butterflies. Also, flies can pollinate certain kinds of flowers. Usually those that are pollinated by flies, those flowers don't smell very good. We tend to think of them as being kind of stinky smelling, and that's because that's what a lot of flies are attracted to, is decaying flesh or organic matter, and so those are the kinds of odors that draw them in. It's like pear flowers, for example. If you've ever smelled pear flowers, they really don't smell that good, but flies are attracted to them and can play a role in pollination. Also, there's some beetles and ants and other kinds of insects that can be more kind of incidental pollinators. I mean, they are attracted to the flowers to get the nectar or other resources, but they're not nearly as efficient as those that we call flower constant. So flower constant things would be like a bee, like they're excited about a certain kind of flower that's blooming now, and they're going to go from that particular flower to the next one like it and to the next one like it, and that's where you're going to get the real benefit of that pollination versus a beetle that may bumble around and get some pollen on it, and it may or may not get to another flower of that same type while it still has enough pollen there to share it.
So you mentioned the bumbling, and I remember watching something on PBS. I don't even remember what the flower was, but it was one that once the bee enters into the flower, it's like it snaps shut, and it forces the bee into the flower to to move into the area where the pollen is, even though the bee didn't want to go there.
Right.
In order to be able to get out, the bee has to go through this area.
Right. And a lot of our native pollinators are actually more efficient pollinators than is even the honeybee. The honeybee is a very generalist pollinator, and there's lots of good things about it. But in terms of some of these specialized flowers, as you just mentioned, they have certain shapes and structures that require a certain kind of bee to really get to the place where the pollen is going to be transferred onto the stigma of the flower. And so there's a lot of flowers that have evolved very closely with their pollinators. But beyond insects, there are other kinds of animals that pollinate, too. We can think about hummingbirds. There are certainly some bats that are important pollinators of some of the desert flowers like yucca. And there's moths that can play a role in pollination. Those are generally the bats, and moths would be more nighttime blooming flowers that are going to be open at night when those pollinators are going to be out. So there is a real diversity of different kinds. But again, I mean, entomologists, I think, can be pretty persnickety about this, that when we talk about pollinators, we're mostly talking about bees.
So why would the plant have an adaptation for one particular pollinator to pollinate it? Because I'm thinking that, well, if there's something disastrous that happens to that bee, well, then
it loses its
it's not going to be able to be pollinated, and then the flower's gone.
Well, and that is that's a good point. But on the other hand, if the flower evolved to be a very specialized type of flower so that it could attract a very specialized type of pollinator, it might have some advantages in competing with its neighbors, so to speak, that if there is a good population of its specialized pollinator around, it might be able to really take advantage of that and really colonize an area very well. And that's what's happened over geologic time, that some of these populations of plants have done very well. What we tend to see in current times with greater pressure from human population on the landscape, I guess that's a way to put it, with development, taking out areas that had formerly had native landscape vegetation that are now sidewalks and streets and homes or whatever, a parking lot, a shopping center. What's happened is that's had a really big impact on some of these more rare or specialized types of plants and their component pollinator, their hand-in-hand pollinator, because when their population area is disrupted, maybe that pollinator, maybe it nests in one area and it only has a certain range that it tends to move around. And then if now its landscape's been dissected, it's not getting over to that other part of the plant population very well. And that's where we tend to see these issues with rare, endangered, threatened plants, come into play. And a lot of times, again, the issues go hand in hand with loss of pollinator habitat as well as loss of habitat for the plant itself.
So as we're talking about bees, I'm guessing it changes from flower to flower, but what are they looking for? What is the flower putting out there as a here I am, come and get me?
Yeah, so what is the attractant? So in general, there's two main attractants that flowers put out. One is pollen. And that's going to be a good source of protein for the insect. And generally, the pollinator is going to be feeding this to its young as a good quick start. Like, when babies are born, we want to give them a good boost of protein in the milk that we feed them. And same thing for the baby bees. They want to have a good boost of protein. So that's the pollen. But also, they need a source of energy, and that's going to be the nectar. So that's the sugar, the carbohydrate that they're ingesting. And so that's often a food source for the bee itself, the adult that's foraging for that so that it can eat and stay active. And they'll eat some pollen too. But also they will include that with their provisions for their young as well. And so they will make, like for many of the native bees, they'll make a little pollen ball that they basically glue pollen together into a little ball using nectar to stick it together. And then they lay their egg on that. And then when the young hatches, it has a nice ready-made food source for it.
So let me back up even further. So what exactly is pollen?
What is pollen? Well, it is one of the reproductive structures of the plant. So it would be comparable to the male sperm of the plant. And it has genetic material that's going to be passed to the female part of the flower. And so for those flowers that require, two different gametes, a male and a female gamete, that pollen is generally then placed on a receptive surface. We call that the stigma, stigmatic surface. And then that pollen tube is, there's generally some different kinds of chemicals there on that stigma that stimulate the pollen to go ahead and germinate. And it grows a pollen tube, like a little tube that grows down through that female part of the flower into the ovule. And then when they join, the DNA is shared, and that allows the full gamete, the zygote, to form, and for, you know, a seed to be produced from that, a seed and a fruit.
What percentage of flowers have both male and female parts to them?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I do know that the majority of flowering plants, do require cross-pollination, so they have male and female parts. But certainly there are exceptions to that. There are many self-fertile plants as well. And not even all plants require require an insect or animal vector to transfer that. A lot of the trees are wind pollinated. Corn is wind pollinated. So there are examples, a lot of grasses and trees are wind pollinated. So there are examples where there's other kinds of mechanisms to move that pollen around.
Although there are usually a lot of bees in my corn when the pollen is available.
They do love corn pollen, so they certainly do take advantage of eating it. But corn does not produce the nectar reward like other kinds of flowers.
So are most flowers then, as opposed to like trees and shrubs, do they tend to have both parts?
In general, yes.
Okay.
Again, it's the most common, but there are always exceptions.
So what is the most efficient pollinator? I guess that depends on the flower.
Right.
And who's attracted to
right.
it.
Right. And so, again, as we were mentioning a few minutes ago, over evolutionary time, some plants have evolved to have a very specific or specialized kind of pollinator. Others are more general flowers that many different kinds of bees, primarily we're talking about, can visit them and have successful passing on of the pollen. Honeybee is a very generalist pollinator, and it can be a very good pollinator, but it's often not the best pollinator. So even for like fruit trees, your apple or cherry trees, the native blue orchard bee is a much more efficient pollinator than is the honeybee. And the reason is that they're generally more flower constant. So when apricots are in bloom or apples are in bloom, they're going to be very focused on just going to, you know, from apricot to apricot flower or apple to apple flower. And that gives you the best, highest rates of pollination success. Also,
where the bees would go from apple to apricot.
They can, but generally they tend, those native, like the blue orchard bee tends to be more flower constant. So where it's kind of more, gets into a mode, like I'm going to visit flower, apple right now, or I'm going to visit apricot right now. Whereas honeybees are more generalist. They'll go to a dandelion,
okay.
And then they'll go to an apple, and then they'll go to something else, you know. And so, yes, they are pollinating. They're moving pollen around, but it's not as efficient as with a more flower constant bee.
And they tend to not come out as early.
Early in the morning. So native bees can be active at lower temperatures, so have a little longer period of activity, which can make them more efficient. Also, they're a little bit smaller, and they tend to move down into the flower a little deeper and do a better job of brushing off pollen onto the stigmatic surface of the flower than does a honeybee. Honeybees sometimes, they can be cheaters. They can kind of sit out on the petal and reach in and get, they're either trying to get nectar or pollen, or if they're trying to get nectar, they can reach in and get that nectar without ever really entering the flower all the way and brushing off that pollen. And so that can be a factor that they can be kind of, robbers of the nectar and not really do the pollination job. Also, where they carry the pollen, a lot of the native bees, they carry it on their belly, basically. They have hairs that are designed to pick up, there are lots of very fine hairs, lots of little feather-like structures on them that pick up the pollen efficiently. And when they enter that flower, they're going to rub their belly down along the stigmatic surface and spread some pollen. Whereas we know that honeybees, many of us know, that they put that in these little structures on their legs so that they can carry lots. They're very efficient that way, but they're not necessarily always transferring that pollen as efficiently as some other bees.
How do most of the bees that we see around here that are not honeybees react to humans? It seems like I remember you telling me one time the blue orchard bee, you basically have to squeeze it for it to sting you.
Right, because they have a different kind of lifestyle. So honeybees are a very evolved insect. They have a very highly developed social structure. They have a nest, a hive, where there's different jobs, roles given out to the different individuals, and the queen of the hive rules the hive by using pheromones, chemicals that she basically, if you can kind of almost call it enslaving her members of her colony. And some are workers, and some take care of the young, and some make royal jelly, and some go off and forage, some patrol the nest and make sure that invaders don't come in. So there's all different kinds of jobs, and that's a very highly evolved social structure. A lot of our native bees aren't nearly, they're still very intelligent, don't get me wrong, but they don't have that highly evolved social structure. They don't have to defend that. They may live gregariously, where there's a number of them together in an area where they find a good nesting spot, but it's generally each female for herself, and so she's making her own nest, provisioning her own nest and laying her own eggs and that kind of thing. And so she's not as protective, and so we don't have that highly protective response that you tend to get with like a honeybee hive. And so we don't tend to get that stinging response. Females can in many cases still do have venom sacs and can deliver some venom if provoked enough, but generally it has to be more where you get them in your clothing, they're trapped against your skin kind of thing, versus just hanging out around their hive and irritating a honeybee colony enough that some come out and try to send you away.
So let's look at bumblebees, because that's been a major issue the last, 10 years or so, declining populations, mm-hmm. especially their pollination efforts for our native wildflowers. And when I was at Blacksmith Fort Canyon the last couple of days, I just saw the most gigantic bumblebees I have ever seen. Uh-huh. And the reaction among some of the kids that I were with, it's just the size. They're just, mm-hmm. oh, no, it's going to get to me, that
so
sort of
huge,
a thing. And so
yeah.
I'm telling them, they're not going to sting you.
They're
just huge.
Pretty
so what's,
passive.
What's the advantage of the size? Because I've seen different sizes of bumblebees, but these were...
Well,
huge.
And just like with any kind of group of organisms, there's variation, and some have excelled in certain kinds of environments. But
it's like a 747 because it wasn't going that fast, but you could hear it just
right.
lumbering
they're,
around.
They're huge, and they do. They look like they're sometimes, especially when they have a lot of pollen on them, they almost like they're like can hardly stay in flight. They keep can hardly keep their height, but they are certain different species, and so different sizes can take advantage of different kinds of flowers, different sizes of flowers. Also, being larger can you might stay warmer, and so a larger bee might be able to come out and be active at a colder temperature. So at higher elevations where warmer temperatures aren't going to arrive to alpine zones until later into the growing season, being a bigger bee might be an advantage because you have better abilities to thermoregulate and get out and be active under colder temperatures. So there's different factors that can that are regulate body size, but certainly the host plants the flowers that you like to visit would be a factor too. A big bee is not going to be able to get into a little tiny flower, but they're going to do well in a bigger flower.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left in the program. If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist, and we're taking your insect questions. Again, it's 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So this week, there's a humongous high pressure moving in, and temperatures will be soaring in southern Utah to upwards of 115 possible, with the possibility of that. In northern Utah, Cache County, 95 degrees, which is still quite warm for us. How does heat affect pollinators?
Well, it affects pollinators and other insects pretty similarly in that it's going to probably affect the time of activity that they're going to have each day. Once it reaches exceeds their level of tolerance, they're not going to be out and active. So for like honeybees that have this social hive, they might have to move into a cooling mode where bees will be waving their wings to try to keep the colony cooler. So they're going to be using energy to do that. Other insects might, again, avoid other pollinators or other insects might avoid sunlight, avoid, the hot areas and try to move into more shaded areas. But a big factor is going to be moisture. Insects need to have enough moisture to survive, and desiccation is a big factor in killing insects. And so if you are trying to, in your own garden, help take care of pollinators and other beneficial insects, having some sources of water is a very important thing to do, especially as we get into high
heat. So even a bird feeder?
Yep, a bird bath.
A bird bath.
A little dripping faucet that drips into a little collection area. Those kinds of things are ideal. If you have a little ornamental pond, you'll see a lot of insects coming to that to be able to get water. And so it's a big factor in dealing with heat. Insects do need access to water.
And the heat also kills the pollen. And will the bees know that when they get to the flower and find out?
I doubt that they can, I don't know. Maybe after pollen is heat killed enough, it might kind of shrivel and not be as conducive for the bee to pick up. But I think if it's fairly short-term thing, they probably can't tell the difference. But yes, too high of temperatures can kill pollen, and then that makes it inviable, that you're not going to get as good of pollination of the vegetables or fruits that you're growing.
So which bees tend to be more solitary?
So there's a lot of different kinds of bees, a lot of diversity, but the main ways that they nest are going to be in the ground or in protected places like in sticks, hollowed out canes or sticks, like elderberry canes are ideal, old raspberry canes are ideal. So those are kind of two primary places that some of these solitary nesting bees hang out. The soil is a good place in the hot summer because there's moisture there, or there generally is moisture there, and that can help them survive. If the sticks or other places where they're nesting are in shaded and wooded areas, that can help keep their nests cool and help them do better.
Okay. And you did mention something. You said canes, and it reminded me. So I'm going to take us on a little side trip here. Is it too late to take care of cane borers in raspberries?
So the raspberry horntail you're referring to?
Well, horntail is now showing up, I noticed in mine.
Symptoms.
But as far as there's a certain time of the year that you can do a soil drench to take care of the raspberry crown borer.
Right, and we are past that now.
Dang, I knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, it's more like May here in Cache Valley.
Okay.
And then, but your other opportunity will be this fall, so late September to early October. That's the other time when the cane borer, the crown borer, has moved down to the base, and that's another good time to take advantage of a crown treatment.
And what about rose stem girdler? Because that's going to come up as well.
Yes, we haven't seen symptoms of them yet, but the adults have already been out and active, and so the time for treating them is also, May to early June. So we're kind of moving past that.
Those are the ones
that
kill me, because you just get all this production starting to go, and all of a sudden the whole cane breaks
about
knee high.
Yeah.
So.
And I've seen lots of raspberry horntail strikes now, too. I was pruning them out of my own raspberry this past weekend.
And then I also wanted to ask you, because I saw these while I was up Green Canyon yesterday, horseflies.
Mm-hmm.
We've not really talked about horseflies. I'm sure there are different species of horseflies.
There's
but
quite a few different kinds.
What's their life cycle like? Why does it hurt so much when they land on you?
Because they have these very sharp teeth, these very sharp mandibles, and they're well designed for cutting into flesh. And that's how their major food source is blood. and that's where they get their protein and their liquid. They get, you know, their water, their lifeblood, that, so to speak, from eating blood from animals. And so they take advantage of, well, wildlife-wise, it would be things like deer and moose and elk. But, of course, when there's livestock around, your horse and your cow and your sheep and so forth, they'll certainly take advantage of those as well. And they generally land on the back or the shoulders, someplace behind the head where either the head can't turn around and grab it or the tail can't come up and swat it. And they'll land and just take their mandibles and cut right in. And then they have lapping mouth parts where they lap up the blood. And so it's not a quick feed. And so generally when people are bitten by a horse fly, it's often not successful for the fly, even if you don't kill it, but they'll bite you. But then you realize that, of course, you jerk your arm or leg or whatever, and you go to swat it and the fly is gone. And so it never gets a chance to actually consume the blood that it released.
I don't know if you can address this. Are humans just more sensitive to that than, say, like a horse? Or just because, like you
probably.
Said, the horse can't reach it?
Yeah, the horse can't reach it, but also if you think about the hide of horse or cattle or deer, you know, it's a lot thicker. And so the fly is going to probably be sitting there for a little while, you know, finding the exact spot where it's going to stick its mandibles in before it takes a bite. Whereas on a human, you know, our skin is much more sensitive. It's not as thick as animal hide.
So what do we do to make sure we don't attract them?
Well, it's
stop
hard.
Breathing.
Yeah, because they're attracted to we're giving off our carbon dioxide. So they use, like, for monitoring, they can use things like dry ice traps and things like that. The same thing as we do for mosquitoes. But we were talking before the show how often they are most abundant right along the edges of wooded areas. So like where there's shade and trees, and just as you get into the opening, because that's often where their prey is going to be. The animals are going to be out, you know, in the meadow, so to speak, feeding, and then they're going to hang out on the edge of the woods and wait for large animals to come along, including people.
And can they be pollinators? I don't suppose they're attracted to any flowers.
Generally, I would say not. I mean, they're mostly looking for that blood meal. I'm sure that they also take advantage of other kinds of food sources. They might take advantage of some nectar or other, or aphid, honeydew, other kinds of carbohydrates to give them a little sugar high as well. But generally, they're more focused on blood.
So in the last minute and a half, what sorts of plants would you put in your own yard to attract pollinators?
In general, you want things that are going to be good sources of nectar and pollen. And Dr. Jim Kane...
So the honeysuckle I put in a couple of years ago will be...
ideal. Okay. So Dr. Jim Kane at the USDA ARS Bee Biology Lab here in Logan, he and his wife put together a really nice fact sheet. It's on the Utah Pests website, or you can go to USU Extension and look for native plants. Forget the exact title, but native plants that are attractive to pollinators, something to that effect. And he's got this great list of plants, and they're primarily perennials that he focused on. But basically, it's lots of different kinds of wildflowers, but it also includes herbs that you might let go to flower, such as coriander or when basil flowers, or sage when it goes to flower. These are all very good sources of pollen and nectar. Generally, what you do is stay away from the things that have been highly hybridized by people, so things like your petunia or your hybridized geraniums. Designed or developed to have lots of showy flower color, but not
so much pollen.
Not pollen and nectar.
And now they've come out with these pollenless sunflowers, and I'm like, that doesn't make any sense to me, because the bees just, the insects just go all over those things. So
yes.
I guess it's so you don't brush pollen onto you, but.
But still, seems silly.
Yes, it does. Well, Diane, thanks for coming in.
Yes, we covered a lot of different topics today.
You've been listening to Diane Alston on The Zesty Garden. She is a USU's extension entomologist. And in a quick one gardening calendar item, Thanksgiving Point Lehigh is hosting their Rose Day in the garden. It's this Saturday, June 29th from 11 to 3 p.m. Thanks for joining us on The Zesty Garden.
Give your hay fever a break this season. Celebrate National Ragweed Control Month by removing these unwanted weeds before they flower. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. You, like me, may be one of the many people that suffer from hay fever, and most cases are caused by ragweed. Pulling this weed now, before the offensive pollen forms, will not only help our allergies this season, but reduces next year's crop of these weeds. Ragweed has dissected leaves that can grow on plants from 1 to 3 feet or more tall. The small green flowers often go unnoticed. You'll find these plants in gardens, along roadsides, alleys, and any disturbed, dry, or other difficult area where it can outcompete desirable plants. Most of us keep the weeds under control in our yards and gardens. Many communities have weed outs for invasive plants and might be willing to add this to their list. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Stay with us for a performance today, coming up next, followed by Concert Hall at 1 and BBC World News Hour at 3. The time now is 11 o'clock.